Good afternoon. Thank you very much for coming. Reese and I would like to express our gratitude to the Department of Education for giving us the opportunity to speak with you about the exhibition Joan Miró, Painting and Anti-Painting, 1927 to 1937, which is currently on view on the sixth floor of the museum, and it's open until January 12th. Just before we get started, I'd also like to let you know that the museum will be hosting a day-long symposium entitled Joan Miró, New Approaches on January 10th, which is a Saturday, from 10 to 5 in the afternoon. We've brought together a distinguished group of international scholars that are approaching Miró's work in a new way, and I think it will be an exciting day. There's information about the program online. So, this exhibition was organized by Anne Umland, a curator in the Department of Painting and Sculpture. I was Anne's curatorial assistant on this project and have had the extraordinary privilege of working with her, for the last 2 years. Anne is a remarkable scholar. She's been at the museum for quite a long time, and I had this privilege and opportunity to work with her on an artist who she's worked on for close to 20 years. So to benefit from her very in-depth knowledge of Miró. The show grew out of the conviction on Anne's part and that of the institution as a whole that as we move forward in the 21st century, a vital part of the mission of the Museum of Modern Art is to articulate new approaches to artists who in the last century were considered modern touchstones, artists such as Miró, Matisse, Picasso, and Paul Klee. How do we make visible for broad audiences today the contemporary nature of artists like Miró's production? This exhibition proposes to answer this question in Miró's case by taking an in-depth, focused look at a singular transformative decade in order to reveal what we hope you will find to be a new Miró. In 1927, Miró very notoriously said, "I want to assassinate painting." And part of what this exhibition does is look at that purposeful, self-conscious provocation in the next decade of Miró's work in 12 series. The exhibition begins with a series of pictures on raw, unprimed canvas, and I'm showing you two works on the screen now. Miró created these works in early 1927 in Paris, and as you can see, he leaves visible broad swaths of what appear to be raw canvas. The way that an artist would conventionally make a painting is by getting some canvas, stretching it around the stretcher bars, and then using glue sizing to tighten up the fabric. The next step in the priming process would be applying a gesso, which is like a thick white paint that has kind of a chalky character to it that would obliterate some of the texture of the fabric. What Miró has done is obliterated that last step. So instead of priming his canvas and then painting on top of that gessoed surface, he's just left us the glue-sized canvas. So the dominant color in these works becomes this toast brown of the raw canvas. And this is a very remarkable thing in the history of art. Artists like Cézanne and Picasso had left areas of canvas unfinished, but to leave the canvas unfinished to this degree is unprecedented. In addition to that sort of very innovative step, Miró also in this series of works and proposes in the show begins to engage with collage strategies in paint. So instead of what we think of as a painting or a modern painting, he uses paint here as almost a collage element. You can almost imagine the blue and the white and the red dots in these works as being glued onto the surface rather than applied with a brush or a way we would kind of imagine painting. So he's moving away and, in a way, dissecting painting in this first series of works. The next series that are arranged in the gallery that follows those pictures on unprimed canvas are Miró's notorious portraits of dancers. I'm showing you two here. On the left is Spanish dancer, and on the right is portrait of a dancer. And these titles are the titles that Miró inscribed on the back of these works. So that is sort of an open question to us to try to figure out how these titles mesh with what we're looking at. And in the case on the work, in the case of the work on the right, all that we're seeing is a wood board that Miró has painted with white ripolin, which was a car paint, so sort of a glossy paint that wouldn't register the artist's hand very much. Then he stuck a cork into the wood board, laid a feather on top of the cork, and pierced the cork with this oversized hat pin. This is just a remarkable work of art, I think, on all levels. There's both an elegance to it, romance and a violence to it. Paul Eluard, a surrealist writer, described it as the barest picture ever created, which is both captures, I think, some of its beauty, but also bareness with nudity, I think, is a kind of a fun connection in this work. So this group of large-scale constructions Miró made in Paris in early 1928, and before he made this series, he wrote to his dealer in Paris, Pierre Loeb, and said, I'm going back to Paris in the winter, and I'm going to create these constructions that are hammering in my head. And I think that that verb is great. When you look at these works, the work on the left, you can perceive in the middle there are two nails driven into the paper. He then said, after I make these constructions in Paris, I'm going to return to Spain and pick back up my fine-haired brushes. So as Miró's thinking about making these large-scale collages, he is thinking forward to creating a series of paintings. And the series of paintings that he creates when he goes back to Montrouge, his family's farmhouse in the countryside of Catalonia, are these Dutch interior paintings, two of which I'm showing you here. So part of what Anne has identified in this decade of Miró's work that the exhibition and its accompanying catalog hope to make clear is that during this decade and inaugurated with these works in the late 20s, Miró begins to think of his practice in oppositional and relational terms. So he's kind of pitting his own practice against one another. So he creates collages, but while he's creating and conceiving of the collages, he's thinking forward to paintings. And it's important to know that for Miró, the paintings were seen as just as much of a challenge to painting as the non-painting things. So about these pictures in particular, he told an interviewer in 1927 in Spain that they had no relationship to conventional painting, which I think is interesting and something that we as 21st century viewers have to kind of work back to try to understand why Miró saw these as radical negations of conventional painting. And part of how I think we can understand that is by knowing the source material that Miró used for two of the Dutch interiors. On the left is Dutch Interior 1, which is in MoMA's collection, and on the right is the postcard that Miró purchased at the Rijksmuseum when he visited Holland and Northern Europe in spring of 1928. He brought back postcards of some of the 17th century Dutch Old Master paintings that he saw in the museum. And this work, this postcard actually itself, it's not just a postcard, it is Miró's postcard that he used. So you see the little pinhole where he attached it to his easel. This postcard, along with all the sketches that relate to this painting, Miró gave to the Museum of Modern Art in the 70s. So looking at this comparison, I think we can begin to try to think about how Miró saw Dutch Interior 1 as a challenge to painting. Some of the things that he's rejecting from the Dutch source are perspective, right? Illusionism, the conception of a painting as a window onto the world. Instead, what Miró gives us are flat, bold areas of color. And the chief conservator of the museum, Jim Coddington, who worked with Anne on the exhibition and wrote for the catalog, has told us that these paints are straight out of the tube. Miró didn't mix his paints at all, so there's a ready-made quality to the paints in and of themselves. So beyond that flatness and rejection of perspectival depth and illusionism, Miró has also very much distorted the human figure. So if you look at the central figure of the musician in the Sorg picture on the right, that's the figure that Miró's portraying in the center of Dutch Interior 1. But quite radical distortions have happened to the figure, right? Instead of this illusionistic face, we get a grimacing red face, and surrounding him is his lace collar, white lace collar, that's been blown up, billowed out to these gigantic proportions. Following this series of works, Miró made a series of paintings in 1929 called The Imaginary Portraits, and here he continues to sort of attack conventional painting. Some of that happens, like we saw with Dutch Interior 1, towards by picking known sort of felons in the Western art tradition. So in the case of the work on the right, Miró's Portrait of La Fornarina, the source material is Raphael's La Fornarina, which is considered a paragon of female beauty. So instead of an image of female beauty, what Miró gives us is this very ugly, obdurate, distorted, monstrous portrait. So all those pictures we've just seen, the Dutch interiors and the imaginary portraits, were exhibited in the first part of an exhibition that Miró organized of his work at his gallery, Galerie Pierre in Paris, in March of 1930. The first 2 weeks had these pictures, and then the second 2 weeks contained the next series of collages that he made, which you're seeing a black and white reproduction of one of those collages. And Miro described this exhibition to a friend in a letter as two rounds in a self-staged boxing match. So he saw himself as sort of vying his practice one against another in this exhibition. And one of the catalysts for Anne organizing the show was getting the opportunity to bring these paintings and collages back in proximity to one another again, to sort of bring back together that two-part show that Miro organized. So this is an installation view of the exhibition upstairs, and in the first gallery where we would sort of be sitting in the vantage point are the imaginary portraits and Dutch interiors behind us. And in the next gallery are these large-scale collages from the summer of 1929, two of which you're seeing on the back wall. So these collages are remarkable on a lot of levels. One of them are, one of these levels is the materials. He is experimenting with really unusual materials in this series. And the work on the left, which is a large collage that belongs to the Kunsthaus Zurich, the black that you're seeing is tar paper, which is a thick pebbled paper that was a roofing material, not a fine art material at all. So it has this really amazing thick texture, and it also kind of captures the light. You can see in the lower left corner of the work how it has this kind of illusion effect of the light catching the texture. In the work on the right, we see in the bottom right corner two little remnants of this tar paper, but then we also see the support that Miro's using is flocked paper, which is a textured paper as well, but it's a fine art material that's a large piece of like watercolor paper, just fine art paper, that a substrate of paint would be placed on, and then adhesive, and then a cloud of particles, wool or wood particles, would be blown onto that adhesive, and the adhesive would catch it. So the paper has a real texture to it. And this is a support that Miro experiments with quite a bit over the course of this decade. You'll see it again and again. So I think this that last series of works, the 1929 collages, and this next series of works, these large paintings on white grounds from 1930, are some of the works for visitors to the exhibition that are the most surprising, the most sort of out of the ordinary, and not that do not align with their idea of Miro, which is interesting given the history of this particular series of work. So what I'm showing you here is Painting Head, which belongs to a museum in France, and it is one of six large-scale paintings. These are 7 feet tall, that Miro created in the winter of 1930 in Paris. We have been able to, for the exhibition, to bring back together 5 of these paintings. The 5th one's not visible in this installation view, but I wanted to show you this so you got a sense of the scale. We've been able to bring back together in this exhibition 5 of the 6 paintings for the first time ever. The 6th one was very regrettably destroyed in a fire in the 1970s, so it no longer survives. That we were able to bring these back together is an achievement in and of itself, but it has a really fascinating backstory. Because Miro, when he made these works, began writing to his friends that he wanted these works to be included in his next one-man show in Paris, to follow up on that one-man show in 1930 that we just talked about. And he writes over and over again, I think this exhibition is going to make a big impact. But it never came to pass. So these incredibly enormous paintings just sat in the basement of his dealer's gallery in Paris. In fact, only one of them was ever exhibited before World War II. So it's paradoxical. The biggest paintings Miro ever made at this time period were sort of invisible in the basement. So the fact that these are not part of our notion of Miro is in part because they were quite invisible to a certain degree. So he makes these large paintings, and he tells his friend Sebastian Goss back in Barcelona, as he's making them, that these will be his goodbye to painting for some time. So Miro was good to his word, and what he next made were these large-scale wood and metal constructions. And those were followed by a large series of small-scale sculptures in 1931 and 32 that are made up of just sort of a huge array of bric-a-brac, stuff you would find on the street. So in the work on the left, you see a bone pinioned to the upper left corner and a bell hanging down from this found piece of wood. And in the work on the right, another found piece of wood that Miro has adhered and nailed to pieces from a clock, areas of sand and just kind of stuff from around his home. So this group of works, the paintings to the collages, continues this kind of dynamic that we trace in the exhibition of Miró, intentionally moving from painting to not painting. So in this case, from painting to sculpture. The next gallery in the exhibition includes a series of pictures that Miró made back in Barcelona in 1933. And what's happened between what I just showed you, these sculptures, and this series of works, paintings based on collage, is that in 1932, Miró moved back to Barcelona full-time. Prior to that, since 1920, he'd been spending half the year in Paris and half the year in Montroig, his family's farmhouse in Catalonia. And because of the economic downturn, that meant that he couldn't show those large paintings. He also couldn't afford to continue to have a studio in Paris. So he's back in Spain full-time, and during 1932, he does some set design for a ballet and makes a series of small paintings, but he kind of gets back onto his feet with this ambitious series of works. And the way that this group of works is conceived of is really remarkable. First, Miró made 18 collages, one of which you're seeing on the left here. And what these are large sheets of white paper that he then adhered to cutouts from just ephemera, like newspapers, journals, in one case, a catalog of machine parts. And you see he leaves a lot of the white paper visible. After he made each of these 18 collages, he would write down in the bottom left corner the date of completion of each collage. Then he's made all his 18 collages, then he sets out to make his 18 large-scale paintings based on these collages. And as he does this, he goes back to each collage and writes down the size of the canvas and the date of the corresponding painting. So Miró left us the trail, sort of the crumb trail, to allow us to bring back together these pairs. And many people have commented that this is one of their favorite rooms in the exhibition. What Anne has done is displayed the collages on sort of angled cases next to the painting, so that this is a case, and I think these are rare for those of us who aren't artists, where we actually get to feel like we have a little bit of insight into the artist's process, what happened from the sketch to the painting. And the transformations are quite remarkable. What one doesn't have in the collage, for example, is color. That all comes from Miró in the painting. Another aspect of the transformation is that what the collages are made up of are these actually kind of traditional little illusionistically rendered drawings, and Miró has totally obliterated that illusionism in the large scale paintings. In this series of works, we've been talking about the back and forth between painting and not painting in Miró's work of the late 20s and early 30s. Here, those two registers come together in a series. Both collage and painting are together. But Miró, in making the collage the sketch, is very much asserting that in this case, the painting is the radical thing. The painting is the thing that is challenging. Those are the works that he exhibited. He did not exhibit the collages. He exhibited the paintings. The next series of works that Miró created immediately following those 1933 large paintings are these drawing collages from the summer of 1933. And here again we see these large sheets of colored flock paper that we saw in the late 20s. And what Miró's done is taken these sheets and adhered to them collage materials, which are postcards in this case, kind of kitschy, nostalgic, sentimental postcards of lovers and a Spanish mantilla in the center of the work on the left, and you know, bathing beauties in the work on the right, and a couple different other cutouts from ephemera, like the starfish that's on the bottom left of the work on the left. And then, so he's got his collage elements, but he interacts with the collage elements with his drawn Conte line. So here, this is another instance of a group of works where these registers of collage and painting, or collage in the artist's hand, come together. And in fact, this group of works was titled Drawing Collage by Miró retrospectively. In 1968, he came to the museum and had a series of meetings with Bill Rubin, who was then the chief curator of the Department of Painting and Sculpture here at MoMA. And they looked at all of Miró's holdings at MoMA very carefully. The work on the left belongs to MoMA. And Miró at that point requested that we change the title of the work to Drawing Collage. And that title very much encapsulates the kind of two registers in these works, that it's both drawing and collage. So I hope these will come as a bit of a surprise, because this is the series of works that for me were the most sort of out of out of sight and not cohering with my idea of Miro that existed before I started working on the show. So what I'm showing you are two of these large-scale pastels that Miro created in October of 1934. These works are quite different from what we've been seeing. In them, Miro brings back some of the traditional techniques of illusionism. So here we do get modeling and shading to create a sense of volume. And that modeling and shading is combined with this palette that the chief curator in the Department of Painting and Sculpture now, Ann Temkin, has described as like a palette that's never been seen before in the history of art. These jarring, hallucinogenic colors contrasted with one another. This series of works is the first series of works for the remainder, the second half of the show, that Miro began to describe as his savage paintings. And that Anne explores this in quite a bit of depth in her introductory essay in the catalog, but that term, savage, is kind of, whereas assassination was the term that Miro was using as the operating term for thinking through his work in the late 20s and early 30s, by 34 in Spain, the political situation is declining, and savage becomes the word that he begins to think about his work through. The specific context for these works is that Miro signed and dated and titled all of these on the back. So the work on the left is figure, the work on the right is woman. The date, October 1934, refers to what was happening in Spain at that time, which is that there were labor strikes that were violently suppressed, and the provincial government in Catalonia tried to gain a higher level of autonomy, and that was violently suppressed. So tens of thousands of people in the region of Spain that Miro lived in were killed during this month. So it was that date would have resonated with a contemporary Spanish audiences referring to this tumultuous time period. And besides that being maybe potentially a coincidence, we know that Miro was aware of these events. He was out in the countryside in Montrouge, but he wrote letters saying, you know, I can't travel because it's too dangerous for me to leave. We also know from correspondence that he continued to work on these works through November, and his dating systems are generally dates of completion. So the fact that he dated these October 1934 and subsequently published them in Catalan avant-garde journals with that date indicates that he wanted us to think through some sort of connection with the political events. For Miro, nothing's ever one-to-one. He's absolutely not representing the political events, but I think as we go through the latter half of the works in the show, you'll see that the political context is absolutely part of what's happening in Miro's work right now. So, the next series of works are a series of some 15 paintings that are all on identically sized sheets of cardboard from 1935. The only thing that this series has in common is that they're on the same sized supports. If you walk into this gallery upstairs, and I hope you either have or will, you might think, what was the curator thinking? Why are all these pictures in the same room? But it's Miro's grouping, and in that room, as in other rooms in the exhibition, we followed Miro's chronology. So the first work in the series is the work on the left, which I think you can see some similarities with the pastels we just saw. And then the an early work in the series is this portrait of a young girl in the collection of the New Orleans Museum of Art. Besides this identically sized sheets of cardboard, Miro described this series as an auto-revision, as a self-critical review. And part of what that seems to have entailed for him is looking back over his practice. So in the work on the right, this is based on a sketch from some old sketchbooks from the 1920s that he picked up and pulled a motif from. And then two other works in this series, Rope and People 1 on the left and Rope and People 2 on the right, take back up this collage strategy, this very materialist collage strategy that we saw in the late 20s. But here, instead of a hat pin, you know, both elegant and violent hat pin, we get this huge hank of rope that Miro has affixed into the cardboard with metal hooks. Surrounding the rope are these visibly anguished figures. So some of the violence of the rope and the violence of the painting sort of inflect each other and combine to make this very aggressive work of art. After creating those paintings, the next gallery in the exhibition is dedicated to Miro's paintings on Masonite and copper from 35 and 36. And again, Miro continues this experimentation with support. So instead of cardboard, what we have here are oil on tempera in the work on the left, tempera on Masonite in the work on the left and oil on copper in the work on the right. And he alternated between these two things. So there's some kind of fun play going on for Miro. You wonder whether he wants you to see the differences between tempera and masonite and oil on copper. Is he trying to create some sort of situation where oil on copper and tempera and masonite resonate and look similar? Certainly the imagery and the palette of the works is consistent throughout the series. These works are very small scale. The you know, this is where PowerPoint sort of doesn't help us out, but the work on the right, which is the two philosophers from the Art Institute of Chicago's collection, is like this big. So they're very small, jewel-like paintings with these amazingly vivid, luscious palettes, and each of the figures and forms within them are very meticulously rendered. So all of this kind of draws us in, right? The beautiful color, the meticulous rendering. But once we get there, what we find are these quite disturbingly distorted figures. There is a play in this series of works, as in many of Miro's works, between humor and aggression. So there is a way in which these works are also humorous. But part of something that Anne argues in the catalog, I think quite persuasively, the context for these works is what's happening in Europe at this time, which is in Spain, we're on the eve of the Spanish Civil War. And in Europe as a whole, there's the rise of fascism. And with fascism, the promotion of this idealized notion of beauty, this Aryan ideal. And I think it's interesting to think about Miro's distorted figures as something of as a rejection of that totalitarian notion of the human body. So the final series of works in the exhibition are a series of paintings from the summer of 1936 on these large sheets of masonite. So in a way, Miro has kind of come full circle from the first series of works in the exhibition on raw canvas. Here we get raw masonite. But with this surface, which is a hard, resistant surface, Miro has gouged into it. If you look at the work on the left, there are areas where he's removed the masonite, and in the lower left corner the lower right corner of that work, he's punctured the masonite. So he's continuing to really experiment with surfaces and sort of aggress against them, to act against them. In addition to that puncturing, these works are made up of oil paint and tar. You see that sort of dripping tar in the center of the work on the left, and this dripping kind of enamel white in the center of the work on the right. So these works, there's something quite repellent about them, I think. So these paintings on masonite, Miro made them in the summer of 1936 as the Spanish Civil War is breaking out. And after he completes this series of works, he goes to Paris, and once he gets there, he realizes it's not safe for him to go back to Spain because of his Republican sympathies. So he gets his wife and his young child out of Spain, and they basically live in exile in Paris. And given this, Miro writes to his dealer here in New York, Pierre Matisse, and says, you know, basically my life has been thrown asunder, and because of this, I'm going to start something radically different. I'm going to start working from life again. And he sets up a still life in the mezzanine of his dealer's gallery in Paris with an apple, a fork, a bottle of gin, a crust of bread, and an old shoe. And over the next 4 months, creates this amazing incandescent painting, which can be seen as both a still life, which it's titled Still Life with Old Shoe, but it also can be seen as a landscape. The edge of the table reads quite like a horizon line with this cloudy, ominous sky behind it. It also can be seen as a history painting. This work is frequently compared to Picasso's Guernica as Miro's meditation on what's happening to his native country during the Spanish Civil War. Here, I think you see some of what I was alluding to with the pastels, that for Miro, he's not representing political events, right? This isn't like Guernica. He's not representing some of the violence that happened during the Spanish Civil War. This work also, while being seen as a masterpiece in Miro's production, has always been seen as something of an anomaly. And one of the things we hope the show achieves is giving this piece its place, that you see, after seeing this decade of work, where this palette comes from, this crazy hallucinatory palette, and the way that this picture is constructed in some ways like a collage, where those black swaths in the upper register and the sort of sky look like they could just be glued onto the surface of the canvas. And then this aggressive tone, the fork piercing the apple, and this ominous, that these things come from this decade of experimentation of Miro's work that is assembled in the exhibition. So, in conclusion, what we hope is that the compressed time period that we focused on in the exhibition reveals the radical range of Miró's experimentation during these years as he struggled not simply to negate painting, to take it apart, but to reinvigorate and redefine his own art during a period of profound economic and political turmoil. Miró created a body of work during this decade that veers from breathtaking beauty to willful ugliness, from radical abstraction to grotesque figuration. Miró is an artist that is familiar to many of us, but whose work from this moment is far less so. So the exhibition hopes to shake things up, to sort of change your idea of Miró, and to present what we hope is a vibrantly contemporary and different Miró for our 21st century moment. Thank you. It is, yeah, oil on canvas. In the blue sweater, yep. Oh, you're just waving. Okay, ma'am in the back.
Thank you for very interesting discussion. I quite a lot to make of the exhibition. You can see it.
Mm-hmm.
I discussed with you before you gave the lecture the contemporary nature. There is something you were showing that reminded me of some street art or graffiti.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is remarkable. Ann Temkin, the newly appointed chief curator in painting and sculpture, has said that something we have to keep in mind is that sometimes the most radical art in this building is from the early 20s. That contemporaneity and radicality doesn't just mean now. That can happen in artists from the 20s and 30s just as persuasively.
Can I ask you another thing? His colors are kind of psychedelic.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know that he was, he was friendly with all the surrealists in Paris, and I'm sure there was lots of funky stuff going on in that circle. But Miró did talk about in his letters and interviews after the fact, looking back on this period, that he was using color aggressively. So I think he saw it as a tactic in this challenge to painting. Sir?
You indicated that Miró was following the political scene in the 30s.
Mm-hmm. That's a very interesting question, and honestly one I haven't thought about, so I couldn't give you a good answer. Anne, are you here? Would you like to?
I am here. I would say that it is during this moment that his engagement is most pronounced and direct and documentable.
Thank you. What she just said, Anne said that her feeling is that this is the decade when he's most engaged with the political situation. In addition, the political situation was remarkable at this time. Fortunately, the Spanish Civil War didn't happen again during Miró's lifetime. So, was there a question on the left here? Yeah.
I had a question on that first photograph that you showed with the two paintings. The white that appears on both of them is on the rock canvas.
Oh, of course, okay.
Gesso, or is it titanium white?
That's a good question. It's actually it's one that our conservators at other museums that lent to the museum looked at carefully, and what you'll see in the medium descriptions is oil and aqueous medium. So a lot of the conservators think that white is aqueous, which would be consistent with a chalky kind of gesso type material that's water soluble. So the answer is, yeah, we do think that with those white areas that he was alluding to gesso.
Okay,
yeah, ma'am, go ahead.
The painting you showed us, which was a replica of a Dutch domestic scene, every figure that Miro transposed, the dog, the cat, the man. Everyone was there except the woman. Is there any theory about that?
Well, I would encourage you to buy the catalog and read Anne's essay. So she talks about that picture in quite a bit of depth. I think Anne thinks that she's been sort of subsumed. Is that the woman has kind of disappeared into the table?
Yes, I think she is there, but she has been radically diminished to the point of which it almost appears as though she's no longer present. If you look back and, oh, well, this is so much fun, right? So Adele, can you show them, like, there's the little breast, like, see right there. And so, you know, I think he's playing with all sorts of things, including how to represent space without making an illusion of it by just making something small and something large, so the woman is further away.
Yeah, go right ahead.
One of the big appeals to me of this period of work is, if you look at the work as even more abstract than what you're describing, it's just the careful play of composition mm-hmm. and the sense of balance that he plays with and achieves with the asymmetrical composition that he plays with. And I'm just curious about his thoughts or approaches to his work even on that level, not representing even anything.
Right. Well, that's a good question. I don't know that I can address it fully, but I would say that Miro was a masterful craftsman, and part of what we're seeing in this decade is, like, in a work like Dutch Interior, he's using all that amazing facility with line and with color, and using his facility with composition, like you're talking about, in these, you know, really radically abstract collages. But part of what he's also trying to do in this decade is subvert that facility, is to create ugly pictures. So these large-scale 1930 pictures are used in the catalog, and I think this is evident by seeing them in person. He really is trying to undermine his own ability as an artist and create aggressively affronting pictures. So, you know, what's remarkable is that part of this same series of willfully ugly pictures, that picture, which is in the Manil collection, which is just breathtakingly beautiful. And I think in 1930, the abstraction of that picture would have felt like a bit of an affront, but it's still part of what's fascinating about, I think, doing a focused show on a decade is that we've been able to bring this series together in depth. So you see this sort of heterogeneity that Miro was holding in suspension within these series, and that kind of, that refusal to add up is part of what he's doing with these series. So, yep, go ahead.
In the last picture, and I might have the world's best imagination, but from where I'm sitting, you look at that loaf of bread, and I see a skull.
As does Rob Lubar, who wrote on this work for the catalog of the exhibition and wrote a very extensive essay on it. And something that adding to that, which is it's fascinating because then it, you know, referring to Vanitas and,
he painted it at the time the war started or was going on.
Well, that's true too, yeah.
Then that's a statement, if it was supposed to be a skull, then that's his statement.
Right, and there's a history within the tradition of Western art history of skulls standing in for a sense of morality. So both the political events and then within the history of Western art, the use of that motif to indicate, you know, serious consideration of one's own mortality.
Well, good. I'm not
nope, not at all. Sir, go right ahead.
Yeah, a lot of the shapes remind me of the cutouts by Matisse, but I'm forgetting now whether Matisse was before or after Miro.
Matisse's cutouts are earlier, right, Anne? Oh, later.
Uh-oh.
There you go. You have to make one art historical error in public for every talk. Matisse was, you know, as was Picasso, were reigning figures in Paris, and Miro in particular had a close relationship with Picasso as a Spaniard, but he was certainly in the mud of all that was going on in Paris, so that's probably an apt observation. Are there any other questions? Thank you very much.
Sorry, before you all rush off.